Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and today our guest is Crystal King, an author, culinary enthusiast, and marketing expert. Her writing is fueled by a love of history, a passion for the food, language, and culture of Italy. She has taught classes in writing, creativity, and social media at Harvard Extension School, Boston University, and many others, including Grub Street, which is, for those who don't know, that's a great resource for writers. It's one of the leading creative writing centers in the U.S. She's a Pushcart-nominated poet and former co-editor of the online literary arts journal Plum Ruby Review. Crystal received her MA in Critical and Creative Thinking from UMass Boston. And the book that we're talking about today, I believe, is her is this your third novel?
Yep, it's my third.
It's In the Garden of Monsters, which is coming out the week that we are talking, I believe.
It came out just a couple days ago.
Which is September 24th, 2024, because you'll be listening to this at a later date. Anyway, her previous novel, The Chef's Secret, was about a famous Italian Renaissance chef, and she's also the author of Feast of Sorrow, the story of ancient Roman epicure Marcus Gavius Apicius, whose name is on the world's oldest known cookbook. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Crystal.
Thank you for having me.
So you really combine history, food, mythology. What drew you? Were you always interested in these subjects, or how did you get so involved in these areas?
Well, I think the biggest thread that runs through everything I write is that Italy is in the center of it. And that was something that happened when I was writing my first novel about Apicius is how the Latin is pronounced.
Okay.
And he's a hard name to pronounce. So I was writing a book about a celebrity chef, basically. And he had a magical set of knives that traveled through history. And I needed an origin story for these knives. And I was reading a lot of books about food history to try to figure this out, which became really fascinating for me. And I came across an anecdote about how this guy, Apicius, died. And he wanted to be, he was an ancient Roman gourmand. The oldest known cookbook has his name on the cover of it. And I thought, this is so interesting. I'm going to write this origin scene. But it turned out that was so much more interesting. And I ended up doing all the research in ancient Rome at the time. And that led me into a lot more food history, which I became really just obsessed about different culinary figures in Italian history. And around the same time, I also went to Italy for the first time in 2010. And since I've been back every single year since then.
Seriously? Every year?
Every year. And I just received my, I just passed the Italian language test to get citizenship. So 'cause my spouses of Italian citizens have to have the test. So that's, I'm obsessed with everything related to Italy, the history, the food, the culture, the people, the language.
So did you say your spouse is Italian?
He is. He's third generation, but he just received his citizenship.
Okay. And had he spent much time in Italy before this interest of yours developed?
We both went for the first time together. So his mother, her family was from the Puglia region.
Which is in what part of Italy?
It's on the east coast, from like straight east from Rome.
Okay. All right. So on the same side as Venice.
Yes, correct.
Yes, yeah.
But south.
Okay. So what's your favorite part of Italy?
Rome. Oh, that's where my heart is. We're city people, and it's the one place where from the moment I set foot there, I felt like this is where I belonged. So.
I have spent more time in Rome than anywhere else in Italy. I've been to Italy. The first time I went was 2003. It was my daughter's college graduation trip. We spent two weeks
fun.
In Italy. Yeah. And then I didn't go back until 2012. I was there I took my niece. And then in 2017, I went twice because my nephew had been living in Rome for quite a while. He was studying for the priesthood and he actually got ordained at St. Peter's Basilica.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, so I went for that. And then a few months later, he was ordained as a deacon there. And a few months later, as a deacon, he was serving on the altar with Pope Francis for his New Year's Day Mass.
Wow, what an honor.
So I went for that.
Yes.
So it was the coolest thing was the New Year's Eve. We were on a rooftop. And
New Year's Eve in Rome is like a wild war zone. It's nuts.
All around, there were explosions.
Yeah, and the paper lanterns floating everywhere, and it's so cool.
Yeah,
we go for New Year's often, actually.
Really, really.
Yeah.
So, when you're in Rome, do you still go to all to the traditional tourist places, or have you done all that enough that you're not interested in that anymore?
We revisit sometimes, but often now I'm meeting with other people and so, who haven't been to Rome. So it's kind of fun to play a little bit of tour guide.
Yes.
Now I do a little bit more more related to my research, because a lot of the things that I'm researching for my books tend to not be connected to the big tourist sites.
Right.
So I'm doing a bit more of every trip I've ever taken has had an element of research in it, whether I'm meeting with a historian, whether I'm taking tours in places where my books are set, that kind of thing. But now I find that I've really whittled it down when I go, and we spend more time with friends than we necessarily do, at least in Rome. Other parts of Italy is a little bit different, but less tours and more friends.
Yeah, yeah. So there's so much history in Rome, and so every corner, everywhere you look, there's some ancient statues, some thing in the side of the wall, the architecture. It's just everywhere.
Yep, that's one of the reasons why I love it so much.
Yeah, and it's a real, of course, you know, when I remember my first trip there, I went to Rome, Florence, Venice, and Cinque Terre. And the thing about Rome versus Venice is Venice was sort of like, it wasn't a real working city anymore.
No.
It's Rome there for the tourists. City. Rome is a real working city, yeah.
Venice has less than 20,000 people that are locals.
Yeah.
But they have tens of thousands more that visit every day.
Right.
Whereas Rome is definitely, I mean, you go into restaurants and most of the time, unless you're in you're in the city center and you're in the real key tourist spots, you can easily go places in Rome where you're the only non-local.
Right, right, yeah. So this book, In the Garden of Monsters, is mostly set in this garden called the Sacro Bosco. Is that how it's pronounced? And yep. Tell me about it and how you learned about it and why you wanted to write a book set there.
So the Sacro Bosco, which means the sacred wood, is a real place in Bomarzo, Italy. And Bomarzo is a medieval village about an hour north of Rome. And there's a palazzo on the hill, and the little medieval village tumbles out down the hill below it. And there's a garden in the valley right below the village. And the garden was created in the late 1500s by this man, Vicino Orsini. And it's a mannerist garden, but it's a garden unlike any that you've ever seen before. There are statues of monsters carved out of stone, the stones that are already in place in the garden. There is a mouth of hell, which is featured actually on the cover of my book. It's an ogre or an open-mouthed monster with big wide eyes, and it says ogni pensiero vola above his mouth, which means all thoughts fly. And that's because there's a trick. If you're standing in the mouth of this monster, and you're whispering to somebody, anyone down on the path can actually hear you. So it's really this crazy thing. But then there's a bench to Persephone and a statue of Demeter. And I use the Roman names Proserpina and Ceres and Pluto for Hades. But then there's also like Poseidon and Ares is represented, and Cerberus and all of these ancient Greek gods and things like that. So I originally visited this garden probably 5 or 6 years ago, and it was sort of an aside. I was originally going to Caprarola, which is about 30 minutes west or east of there. And Caprarola is a town that Cardinal Farnese, who was the richest man in Italy in the 1500s, he had a palazzo that he built there in a pentagonal shape, which is magnificent. And it's what the U.S.'s own Pentagon is based upon, is the structure of this palazzo. And I originally had gone there because I was researching a book about a Baroque steward named Antonio Latini. Vincenzo Cervio. I've got so many culinary figures in my mind. Vincenzo Cervio, who was the meat carver to Alessandro Farnese. And our driver said, well, you know, there's this interesting place nearby. Do you want to check it out? I'm like, okay, sure, let's go. And I hadn't planned on writing a book there. But then during the pandemic, I was struggling to sell this book about the meat carver. And the publishing world was just in a strange place, and everybody was in a strange place in the middle of the pandemic. And a friend of mine, Chris Walder, who wrote this wonderful Gothic novel called Unnatural Creatures, which is about the women of Frankenstein, she and I were talking about just the state of publishing and how frustrating it was to not sell this book of mine. And I was like, I just want to sell a book. What could I write that would sell? And she said, oh, well, Gothics are hot, of course, because she'd just written one. And I thought, if I were going to write a Gothic, what would I write? And I immediately thought of this garden. And then when I started revisiting the garden, realizing, oh, the statues in the garden that I saw have a lot to do with the myth of Hades and Persephone. And that was it. And then I discovered in my research of the garden that Salvador Dali went there in 1948, and he filmed a little tiny movie, which you can see on my website, crystalking.com. And I thought, this is interesting. And then Dali suddenly appeared in this story. So,
okay. So let's, first of all, what actually defines something as a Gothic novel?
So Gothic novels have to do, I should probably get better on the definition, but Gothic novels have a few things in common. They tend to be really based upon a place. They tend to have some eerie, ghosty, dark sort of side to things. The setting is really the heart of a Gothic novel. If you think of a lot of novels like, I'm trying to think of like Mexican Gothic, for example, the setting of the house where it takes place is important. The novels of Frankenstein, which have to do with the lab. There's a lot of the place and the atmosphere that a lot of Gothics represent. And in my case, the garden is a real, and the palazzo where this novel is set is a real part of the story. And so that has a lot to do with it. It's I should probably go up on the
and there's definition. Usually some ghosts involved.
Yes. Or... yeah, ghosts or supernatural or something a lot to do with like the dead.
A lot. Okay. Now, another very sort of popular trend right now is retellings of myths. So
yes.
You combined the Gothic with that aspect. And
yep.
Is that, you know, it's sort of when I was reading this, I'm like, well, I wonder where her entry point into this was. Was it the garden? Was it the myth? Was it Dali?
It was the garden.
It was the garden. And so tell us, for those who might not remember the myth of Persephone and Hades, what's the basic kind of story?
Yeah, so
there?
It's the explanation for the seasons is what it is. interestingly enough, it's not actually a Greek myth. It's a Sicilian myth. And that's because Hades, his home in the myth is in Mount Etna, which is in Sicily. And he sees Persephone, this beautiful maiden, gathering flowers at the base of the mountain. And he thinks, I want to marry that woman. I want that woman, whether it's marriage or something else. But right. he wants this woman. And so he says to his brother Zeus, who's the king of the gods, I want that woman. And Zeus says, oh, that's your sister's daughter. You can have her. And it's very incestuous, right? And he says, sure, you can have her. And so Hades goes and he takes her forcefully into the underworld. Some of the myths have her being, it's often called the rape of Persephone, or rape of Proserpina in the Roman term. Proserpina is Roman, Pluto is Roman for Hades, and Ceres is Roman for Demeter. And some of the myths, though, do have a romantic element, that either she falls in love once she gets there. But regardless, Demeter, her mother, is just, what on earth has happened to my daughter? Where is she? And when she discovers that her daughter is in the underworld, she flips out and she blankets the world with snow. And then everybody starts to starve. The animals die. The people are dying, right? And Zeus says, this can't do. Hades, Demeter, you have to stop this. And she says, you bring my daughter back. And so Hades says, I can't give her completely back to Demeter, because Persephone has eaten some seeds in the underworld. And some of the myths say three, some say six, and I run with the six. And
these are pomegranate seeds, right?
Correct. Yes. So in this myth, because she's eaten some of these seeds in the underworld, she cannot go back completely. So what she does is she comes back for a few months out of the year. And in the fall is when she's starting to go into the underworld. Winter is when she's there. Spring, Ceres is getting excited, or Demeter's excited that her daughter's coming back. And summer is when she's back. So that's the myth of Hades and Persephone in a nutshell.
So what is it about the pomegranate? What is the, does it have other meanings in mythology, or is this the main one?
Well, I think there's lots of pomegranate seeds in all sorts of different mythologies in a lot of different religions. I think you can find pomegranates going in pretty much in almost every single ancient religion in some way, particularly in the Middle East and in Europe. But this is the myth that most people connect with the pomegranate seeds. And that's because pomegranates have been around for a really long time. And they're jewel-like, and they're beautiful, and they're tasty. So they naturally just became a real centerpiece in a lot of different mythologies and religions.
Okay, so you're taking this story, but you're changing it quite a bit.
Yes.
So tell me what that thought process was like, how it evolved into the story of In the Garden of Monsters.
Yeah, so I changed the myth quite a bit. And I can't tell you exactly, because I'll spoil it, and I don't want to do that. But it's a story that, well, first of all, it's set in 1948. And it's basically told from the point of view of a model that Salvador Dali brings to this Garden of Stone Monsters. And you find out very early on that she doesn't remember much. And she goes to this garden because there's something in Dali's paintings about pomegranates that really interests her. And so she decides to go and be there in part of the garden. And she I totally lost the train of thought on where I was going with that.
Okay. The changing, so there's this model.
Yes.
Now, so you knew that she was, I don't want to give away too much, but
yes. So
this is hard to talk about without giving it away.
She's trying to figure out who she is. And when she gets to this garden, she discovers that there is so to give you a sense of this, the book takes place in the course of 1 week, and she is there with Dali and his wife Gala, and the other characters in the book. There's very few characters in the book. There's Ignacio, who is their very handsome and enigmatic host. There is Lillian, who is Julia's best friend, and she appears at the beginning of the book, and she and comes to the garden in the middle of the book. And then Paolo, who is their cameraman, and he's the one that I have filmed this little movie that you can find on my website. And then there's Jack, who is this big jock, handsome boy next door that that Julia is interested in. And so Julia goes to this garden because she wants to discover who she is. She can't remember her past. And there's something in those pomegranates that Dali was painting that really inspires her. And she's a model at the Accademia delle Belle Arti in Italy. And she wants to learn more about painting. She's a painter. So she's like, I'm going to go because Dali, there's this connection I have that I feel like I have, but also I can learn from a master. I'm going to go. And so she goes against.
And she's getting paid very well.
And she's getting paid handsomely, very handsomely. Yeah. Enough, like more than she would make in a year doing anything else. And so she's surprised, but delighted, and decides to go. And her friend Lillian is like, what are you doing? This guy is nuts. Don't do it.
And the reason, part of the reason they think he's nuts is because, and this is something I know very little about Dali except, you know, his paintings. And I didn't know he was a fascist. And yeah.
He was, a lot of people don't really know much about him. They know his paintings are strange and they know about his milky clocks. But he was kicked out of the Surrealists for being, having fascist interests. And he was somebody who, although I have to say, I don't think he was a fascist by the true sense of the word. He admired Hitler and he admired Franco, but I think he was enamored with the power they wielded. I don't think he was interested in their policies or the things that they did. Which also says a lot about him. I don't think he cared about the bad things that they did, but he was fascinated with the idea of how much power and adoration that they had, the way that they commanded power. And that's because he was a narcissist. He was the classic textbook case of narcissism. And everything he did was to shock and awe. And that's what those dictators did. They shocked and awed the world in all sorts of ways. And he was interested in the shock and awe part. And it didn't matter if it was nefarious or not. That's what interested him. He did become very religious later in life. And I always wonder if he he thought about those things. I don't know. Like, he actually has paintings in the Vatican. There's several paintings. Religious paintings in the Vatican Art Museum that he did, and some of his most masterful paintings are one of the most masterful is the one of Christ on the cross. So he never really talked about his religion. It came across in his art, but 10-15 years before he created that painting, he did one of Hitler masturbating. So
oh my goodness,
he was a deviant, and he was not. He and Gala had a very strange relationship. He was a very sexual person, but he was not interested in sex. He was interested in watching. And Gala had many paramours, which he sanctioned and he knew about. When she was in her 70s and 80s, in fact, he bought her a castle in Pubol, Spain, near their house, 50 miles away from their house. And that was where she could entertain her lovers. And he could only visit if he had a written invitation. But he loved his wife. He loved her and worshipped her throughout their marriage, which was a long marriage. And he dedicated his cookbook to her. He painted countless paintings of her. His tarot deck has her as the empress. And she was everything to him. And she was his manager and the one that helped him make a name for himself, and the money that he saw in his lifetime could directly be attributed to her.
Yeah. Well, she seems like a fascinating character in and of herself. She doesn't come across as very sympathetic at all.
No, she's not. And history has this, you know, right now we're seeing this resurgence of retellings of historical women that have been maligned by history and men who want to suppress the history of women. But there's a lot of information about Dalí and Galá, and a lot of autobiographies of people that were in their circle that paint her all in the same way. She was a ruthless, not very nice person, mean. She's definitely a villain in my book, but I don't think a villain per se as much as she just was not a nice person. She just wasn't. And but it didn't matter. Dalí still loved her. And but it's interesting because although she's not likable in my book, she was likable to the surrealist artists. She wasn't an attractive woman. She was very plain of face, and if you saw her, she's somebody that you might not necessarily notice in a crowd, for example. But she had a charisma that men were very fascinated with. She had some sort of sexuality. And there was, it was said that the surrealist artist at the time, before Dalí, that they did their best work when they were sleeping with Galá.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So
so she had something.
She was, the two of them were are absolutely fascinating to research. And now, Dalí was charismatic and he was a genius at art as well. And so he had this side of him that people were enamored by, but he also had this side that a lot of people were like, what the heck, you know?
One thing I found interesting is in the afterword in your book, you mentioned that you weren't sure whether to include them in the story. It would have been a completely different story without them.
Yes, it would have been the book would not be the same. Dalí
no.
is an important character in the book. He's not the main character, but he's, I would say there's really three main characters in this book, Julia being the main one, but, and I'm not going to tell you who the other one is. You're going to have to figure that out, but Dalí of course is, and yeah, removing them would make sense, but I wasn't sure if I wanted to, when I first thinking about the book and starting out, I didn't know once I was started researching him, like, should I include him? Because this guy is off the rails. I mean, and I include a lot of more of his horrible side in the book. He had really deviant ideas. He was obsessed with death. He was, he just was strange. And he's somebody who would be canceled in 20 seconds in our culture today. And I don't want to be canceled, right? So
yeah.
That's, so I really struggled. Do I go there? But I think it's important to know about people in history. And
yeah.
I hope that's something that, you know, now a lot of people might've admired his paintings, but not really understood a lot of what goes on behind the scenes and who he was, the kind of person he was. And I can appreciate his art in a way that I didn't before. I didn't actually like much of his art, but I can appreciate a lot more than I did before. And I don't like him I don't think he was somebody that I particularly like, but I am very fascinated by what he was able to accomplish in this world, and his influence cannot be overstated. He was literally one of the most important artists of the 20th century. And so people should know more about him, the good and the bad.
True, true. You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Crystal King, author of In the Garden of Monsters. So let's talk about food.
Oh, I can talk about food for a long time.
So a big part of this book is these elaborate meals that this group of artists, models, cameramen, and hangers-on are given at this palazzo. And how do you know, the combinations of foods and so forth. It's like, how do you come up with those?
Well, having written a couple books about culinary figures helped. So, but what was fun about this book is that I wasn't writing about a chef or some Baroque steward. I was just getting to, my characters just had to eat meals. There's 7 days that they're there and they need to eat lunch and dinner and breakfast and, you know, they need to eat food. So, and there's pomegranate seeds involved and my character needs to get some pomegranate seeds in her, or at least Dali thinks that she needs them. And so I devise all these different meals that, and but most of them are taken from historical periods in time. I borrowed some recipes from Scoppy, who is the main character of my novel, This Chef's Secret. He was a celebrity chef in the Renaissance. And then I have like recipes from Artusi, for example. He was a very famous culinary figure in Italy in the late 1800s. And most of modern Italian food is based on or at least he represents a lot of what we understand as modern Italian food. And like there's a scene from the Hypnero Tamachia Polifili, which is a medieval novel about this guy, Polifilio, whose lover has jilted him. And he has this dream where he tries to get her back. And this dream is long and weird and rambly and has all these crazy illustrations in this the book. And it's from like the 1400s, late 1400s. And one of the scenes is a dinner where all the servers, their clothes change with every course, the colors do, and the plates change colors and the tablecloths and the food is outlandish and wild. And so I take a whole scene from that book. And then there's Dali. He has this cookbook that comes out in 1973. And I thought, okay, I'm going to give a nod to the future of that cookbook. And so we have a meal based on the foods in that cookbook. And one of the foods, interestingly enough, is avocado toast.
Oh, you're kidding.
But avocado toast is very different than what we know of as today. Avocado toast in his mind had a lamb brain, and it had tequila.
It had
in it.
What?
Lamb brain.
A lamb brain?
And tequila.
And tequila.
Yep.
Okay, that's different.
Yeah.
That's
so.
Sure.
Yeah. So he but the recipes are all these really over the top French recipes from restaurants that actually still exist today. One of them is Maxim's. I can't remember all the rest of them, but there's these Parisian restaurants that he used to frequent when he and Galat lived in Paris. And they're really difficult recipes. I mean, if you're a chef with a Michelin star restaurant, you probably could recreate these with your, you know, easily. But for a home chef, they're just elaborate and very difficult. But there's things like, you know, he recreates some of the dishes from the Renaissance, like the peacock that looks alive, but then all of its babies are roasted below him and they're actually little quails kind of thing. And then he has like towers of crayfish. But the cookbook is so cool because it's this huge cookbook. I mean, you can buy it today. It was reissued by Taschen, and it has a lot of his art interspersed with all the recipes. And so that's super fun.
Wow. Wow. Well, Crystal, why don't you read a little bit from In the Garden of Monsters for us?
Sure. So I'm going to read two different parts. One is the prologue. Just a little bit from the prologue. And the prologue is from a different point of view as the rest of the book. But it's important not to skip it because it gives you helps place you in this world.
Definitely. I think you'd be a little confused.
And then I'm going to read a little bit from the first chapter as well.
Okay.
So we're going to start you out in Bomarzo, Italy in 1547 to 1560. This is actually set in 1547, this particular part. It took me years to find Giulia Farnese, but no time at all to win her confidence. I did so with an unassuming cherry rose tart. It had been nearly 100 years since I last looked upon her face, but from the moment she pulled the golden tines of her fork away from her lips and she looked to me, not her husband, I knew my influence had taken hold. "You truly are a maestro, Adonis," she said, closing her eyes to savor the sweet floral flavors, "and a welcome addition to our kitchen." Madonna Farnese, you flatter me. I gave the couple a polite bow, my gesture more fluid than human custom, and turned back to my earthly duties. It seems you will eat well when I am gone, Vicino joked behind my back. But don't eat too well, my beauty, or you won't fit into those lovely dresses. Julia laughed, and my heart warmed. Oh, she would eat well, I vowed. Very well. So that's the little bit from the prologue that to kind of whet the appetite. There's a little bit more to the prologue, but I'm going to move on to Rome in 1948, and we're meeting Julia for the first time. Julia, I still don't think you should go, Lillian said as we sat down at the base of the Spanish steps near the entrance to the famous Bowdington's tea room. It was late in the afternoon and the sunlight glowed against the boat-shaped fountain that Bernini's father had designed nearly 300 years before. I sighed. Lillian and I had been arguing ever since I had received the invitation to sit for Salvador Dali. You know this is an opportunity I can't pass up, and you also know how much I need the money. Dali had made waves in the city papers because he was in town creating sets for the Rome Opera, but he was also painting on the side, which was good for me. I had graduated from the Accademia di Belle Arti in the spring, but continued to take classes to maintain my student visa, and I modeled to pay the bills. Dali had inquired about me by name. I don't know how he had heard of me, but it was often difficult to find a naturally blonde model in Rome, and I assumed that another person I had sat for referred me. He wanted to paint me in the guise of an ancient goddess, Proserpina, the Roman counterpart to Persephone. Lillian was convinced it was a bad idea. Come on, he admires fascists, for God's sake. You have to be pretty bad to be kicked out of the Surrealists for having weird views. I know, but he's been spending a lot of time in New York, so maybe he's changed. It's only for a week. He's one of the best painters in the world, Lil, and watching a maestro like him at work isn't something I can pass up. It's only a week. But I hated that she was right, and I felt guilty that I still planned to go. Lillian tried a different angle. Okay, then. But he's also a deviant. You'll be naked in front of him. His wife will be there, I protested. There's nothing to worry about. He only has eyes for Gala. Lillian, who worked as a shop girl at a luxury clothing store, had never understood how I could be just as comfortable dressed as I was undressed. But the art scene had always been comfortable with nudity, sexuality, and promiscuity, while the rest of the populace was not. My friend pulled a ribbon from her pocket and began tying up her long, dark hair. You don't even like surrealism. That's not true, I insisted. I just hate most surrealism. In fact, I was somewhat obsessive about surrealism, but it was no longer in vogue to say so. Abstract expressionism had taken the art world by storm, and I wanted to sell my work. So I followed the trends, inspired by the likes of Klein and Rothko. But oh, the surrealist tugged at my heart and soul. It had been Dali's dream caused by the flight of a bee around a pomegranate a second time before waking that lured me in when I was in Madrid. The painting of a naked woman. Dali's longtime muse, his wife Gala, resting on rocks in the middle of an ocean, a pomegranate by her side, had a lot going on. In the sea, another monstrous pomegranate births a rockfish that spits out two tigers, their mouths wide open, their claws ready to rip the woman apart. There's also a floating gun and Dali's first spinally legged elephant, but it was the pomegranate that had really caught my eye, how it opened up, bursting with life. And yet the woman lay asleep, unable to react to all the emotion and life around her, lost in a dream. There was something in that painting that resonated with me, that made me feel a little less fragmented. I couldn't explain that to Lillian. She would never understand. She knew the newest version of me, a fabricated tale, born in Italy, raised in Manhattan by an eccentric aunt after my parents' tragic deaths, and educated in Boston before returning to Italy post-war. But the truth is, my earliest memory is emerging from the Pantheon years before into the streets of Rome and a stranger's kindness to help me reach the Academia. Beyond this, my past is a void. I have no recollection of family, childhood, or schooling. A doctor once dismissed my amnesia as temporary, but it never resolved. To dispel any awkwardness, I concocted a fictitious past. This story satisfied the curious and accounted for my advanced intellect and erudite speech, traits I never fully understood in myself. I claimed an education at Radcliffe and feigned ties to high society, a narrative that seemed plausible enough to explain my idiosyncrasies. But the way I felt when I looked at that painting by Dali was one of the reasons I couldn't turn this job down. There was a connection there, and I had an inexplicable need to discover what it was.
Thank you. That was Crystal King reading from In the Garden of Monsters. So obviously, your books require a certain amount of research, and I'm curious about whether you start writing and then figure out what you need to know and go research it, or whether you do a whole bunch of research first, or a mix of the two.
I usually spend a few weeks or so, maybe a month or two, just really researching and understanding. And often this is happening when I'm working on edits on something else. So right now I'm actually working on edits for a novel that's coming out next year, but I'm already mapping out the next story. So I'm thinking about it, I'm researching it, I'm out doing some outlines and putting the ideas together. And in a book like most of my books are, I would say I'm moving more and more towards the fantastical in what I'm doing, but there's always an element of history in them because I'm fascinated with it. And we can learn so much from history. And so I spend a lot of time reading and trying to find all the bits of information I can about the subjects that I'm talking about. And then I'll usually put together a loose outline, usually in a spreadsheet. And that's helpful.
A spreadsheet?
Yeah, I do a spreadsheet because – but it's a pretty elaborate spreadsheet. It has like – it's broken down. I do a couple – sometimes if I'm doing a historical novel, I will have several spreadsheets. One of them is just one with a timeline that goes all the way across on the top of the time frame that my book is set. And then on the side, it's like – what happened in the, and like if I'm writing a Renaissance novel, it's what's happened in the papacy, what happened in history, what happened in science, what happened in this time frame, so that I can map out all the things that occurred during the time frame that my book is set. And so then I can take those ideas and weave them into my story. And then I usually have another spreadsheet that outlines it by chapter. And I work pretty chronologically. I know a lot of authors will write scenes and then just map them all together later. And I can't really do that. Although I did write the last chapter of Feast of Sorrow first, but that's unusual. Usually I prefer to just go from the beginning to the end. And so I map it all out, what I think is going to happen, just the beats of the story. And then I start writing. And about halfway through, I usually abandon the spreadsheet and it just emerges. Things happen. So there's a lot of things that happened in this book that I was like, oh, I didn't know that was going to happen. And particularly my first couple of novels, I killed off a lot of people in my first two books. And there were many times when I was like, whoa, I didn't know that person was dying today. So, and I don't know what that says about me, but.
Okay. So you outline it, but you don't stick to the outline.
Not entirely. No. I mean, I stick to the bones of it, but it helps get the shape in my head. And that's super helpful to start out.
And does the end is the ending ever different than what you thought it was going to be when you started out?
Sometimes. In this book, I wasn't exactly sure. I knew how it would resolve, but I didn't know what it would look like when it resolved. And until I really got down to the very end of it and wrote the last couple of chapters, I had a vague sense of where it was going. I mean, I think in this book in particular, I pantsed my way. Writers will often talk about, you know, when you fly by the seat of your pants. So I pantsed my way through probably the last like six or seven chapters and just let it naturally flow. And that's a little bit more unusual. I generally have, in my historical novels, I have a sense of certain historical things. There's beats that I have to hit. There's certain things that happen in history. Like I know when my character died. He died in 1577. So I have to like figure that out, right? So so in this kind of a novel, though, I didn't have that. So I really just sort of made a lot of that up as I went along. And instead, in this one, what I had to concentrate on was getting Dali's character right, because I wasn't working with a timeline of history. I was working with a historical character and their personality that I've inserted into this novel. And so I spent a lot of my research trying to get the shape of him and his wife correct, so that they would behave hopefully in the ways that if they actually had gone to this crazy garden, they might have behaved. So it was a little bit different for me in that regard.
Okay. So, yeah, because in some sense, this is historical, too, because you have real historical characters.
Yes.
But, yeah. But it's also
mythology,
fantasy, mythology,
and gothic, and ghosty. And
so it's a little hard to pigeonhole.
Yeah. It's Did funny. That... My publisher has, like, if you look at the Kindle categories, each book, like the Kindle's different than the Audible, than the hardback on the categories, because it
really
falls across so many categories.
Right. So. Did that make it any harder to sell? Because it didn't fit neatly in a category?
I think it might have helped me, because right now there's a lot of mythologies out there, and this is different. This is a real different mythology. It's not at all like it's not a retelling in the ancient past like most of them are these days. So that helped. It's not a pure Gothic novel in the sense of some of the Gothics that are out there, because I would say it's probably, if anything, it's probably more Gothic than anything else. It fits that category
right.
The best. But it's also historical fiction because of Dalí, and you learn so much about Dalí and his world in it. So yeah, I think it helped me, because it's so unique. It might not be easiest for booksellers to figure out which part of the bookshelf to put it on, but the good news is that it'll appeal to a lot of different readers, I hope.
That is true. That is true. Did you always want to write novels?
I was writing when I was really young. I was a super early reader. I was reading quite literally by the age of 2. It's the only kid in my kindergarten that could read. And I was writing from the second I could hold a pen. A lot of short things at that time. But when I was 10, somebody had the foresight to send me to like a young writers conference, and I got to meet Madeline L'Engle. That was really cool. So she was just a hero of mine back then. I was reading adult novels by the time I was 10. My father was an avid reader, and he had to hide a lot of the sexy novels that he had from me, because I couldn't read them at that age. But I didn't really start writing novels until I was almost in my 40s, and because I just felt they were big. They felt like I'm not the most patient person, and so I spent more of my time writing poetry, and I edited a literary novel, and I was always had my hand in it, but I didn't think I could write something so long. It just felt big. But then I was trying to shop around a manuscript that I had put together when I did my thesis for critical and creative thinking for my master's at UMass Boston. And it was basically this a book about how writers in progress can move their stories along. And I based all these exercises on the business and science sectors on how they do brainstorming for products, and how writers can take those same ideas and use them on their own story. And there's lots of books out there for writers that need to get started. How do I start a book? And how do I get ideas? But there's not a lot for, like, I need my character to go from point A to point B. So I started shopping this around, and all the feedback I had from agents was, no one knows who you are, so you need to either write a book using these exercises, or have somebody else write a book using these exercises, or you need to teach. And so I started teaching. I've taught a variety of universities around Boston. And then I thought at some point, I should probably write the book. I think that's what I need to do. I need to actually write a book.
So you wrote a novel in order to sell a nonfiction book.
Yes. And the nonfiction book, we're still trying to sell it, because it's niche. It's a niche thing. So I'm working on the get famous, and then everybody's going to buy the book, right? So.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Because what was it? Who was it that wrote a book on writing that? I think it might have been Stephen King. You know, he was so famous. Everybody wants to
read
his
definitely.
Thoughts on writing. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of the authors who have become very well known, like Murakami and the guy who wrote Fight Club, Chuck. Totally, his name's escaped.
Yeah, I can't think of that either.
Yeah, but like you know, a lot of writers later on end up writing books. I started the other way around. I wrote the writing book first.
So when you started out, you had already fell in love with Italy at that point. And so you decided to write a book, a historical novel set in, was it Renaissance Italy, the first one? Or
Ancient Rome.
What time? Ancient Rome.
And I actually fell in love with Italy when I, by the time I'd finished it. My mother-in-law spoke some Italian, and my husband is Italian, but I wasn't overly, I wasn't super interested until I really started doing all this research. And then I thought, oh, I should go there. And I had finished the novel, but I went, and I ended up changing a lot of the novel after I visited. The moment I set foot in Rome, I was like, this is it. This is where I need to be. This is where I belong. And then everything just became very naturally, everything gravitated around it. So I'm moving a little bit beyond my novel that comes out next year, is set in Rome. It's set in all parts of Italy, but it's also set partly in London. So I'm moving a little bit out, but not, I'll never give it away.
So with feeling that way about Rome, why not move there?
Oh, that could be in the future. We'll see. You know, part of the getting the citizenship makes that a lot easier. So.
Ah, yes. Yeah. Good point. So you wrote this first book. How did you find your publisher for it?
So this book is with a different publisher than my first two novels. And that's because during the pandemic, it was just really hard to sell books. It just was difficult for not just for me, but for every one of my author friends was really struggling. My editor at the time told me she wasn't interested in my Renaissance novel because historical fiction and the Renaissance wasn't selling. And this was maybe 2 weeks before Maggie O'Farrell's Marriage Portrait hit the best-selling charts. So, so I don't know what to think about that, but publishing is a strange industry. They kind of try to follow the trends of what people are talking about, but that isn't always necessarily what people want to read. I think I have a marketing background, so I'm a little bit more, I want to really get a sense of who audiences are, and the book audience is a little elusive, and certainly for publishers. So, they tend to follow trends, and sometimes by the time they followed the trend, it's not happening anymore. And then the trend will come back. So you know, historical fiction could be hot again in like next week. So, you know, so for this book, I started writing this book because I couldn't sell historical fiction. I was like, I got to sell something. I want to write for a living. This is what I want to do. Cause I have a day job, which I fortunately, if I have to have, if I can't be writing books, I actually really love my other job. I work in the software sector, teaching social media and AI, actually, which is interesting.
Oh, cool.
But I really would love to write books. And so in this particular case, I thought, okay, if I want to write a book that is different, but I would love to write it, this garden is such a great place, and there's so many opportunities to write about stuff that's not necessarily historical fiction, but that still contains a lot of the loves that I have. And I always loved more of the fantastical stuff when I was growing up. And when I want a good read to just like lose myself in, it's generally a fantasy novel. So it feels like a natural path for me.
Right.
But this book really appealed to my editor at Mira Books, and it just worked for her and the catalog. And I'm so lucky because she's had a really a real great impact. She has had a great impact on the trajectory of the book, of course, because she's my editor. But one of the things that is super cool is that a week after she bought the book, she went to the Sacro Bosco, and she was able to be in the garden and see it. So when we were doing the edits, she knew all of she knew like where all the statues were located and next to each other. She had a sense of it. And the cover of the book itself is really cool because, so last year was the 500th anniversary of the garden, of when Vicino Orsini created it. And normally the orco, the mouth of hell, or the ogre, which is just this big face, and it has this gaping mouth and these wide open empty eyes. But for the 500th anniversary, they had all these art installations, and one of the art installations, they had put this cool glass in the eyes. And so we used that on the cover of the book, from one of the pictures that she had taken of these cool glass eyes. So the eyes on the cover are not hollow like they are in real life. They have this like energy that's from the glass eyes.
Cool. That is awesome. So I think I saw something here about an accompanying cookbook.
Yes. So for all of my books, because they have so much food in them, I have worked, I have a downloadable cookbook, for each one of my books, and there's one for this one. And I've had the great pleasure to work with, food book bloggers and, food historians and chefs, to recreate a lot of the dishes in the book. And so and I love to bake, and my husband is a cook, or he's not a cook, but he's a home cook, and he loves to cook, so we complement each other really well. And so that passage I read, the first in the prologue with the cherry rose tart, I have a recipe for the cherry rose tart, for example, that's in the cookbook.
Fantastic.
And there's a couple of the Dali recipes, there's some of the more traditional Italian recipes that are in the book. There's our ice cream recipe that's inspired by the garden. It's so fun. I love doing that. And then based in Boston, and in the Boston area, what I've been able to do for each of my books, and I'll be doing that again this fall, is working with some restaurants to have dinners based upon the novel.
Oh my goodness. That's fantastic.
Yeah. It's super fun.
Wow. Now, a downloadable cookbook is great, but wouldn't it be nice to have a printed version of it?
Yes. Well, someday, if I keep doing these, you know, maybe we
can
collect it all.
I have quite a few cookbooks that I hardly ever cook anymore, you know, empty nester and all that, but I like cookbooks.
Yeah, I do too. I have so many cookbooks.
I have my grandmother's cookbooks. And I just, sometimes I just like to read cookbooks.
I think that's one of the reasons why I actually like the Dali cookbook, is because it's very readable. And he has a accompanying cookbook called The Wines of Galah. It's actually not a cookbook. It's just about wine. And that's super readable. And art all the way through it. So, yeah.
Well, Crystal, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us, talking about In the Garden of Monsters. I have a closing quote today about Rome from Giotto di Bondone. Perhaps, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly.
It sounded
Rome,
right.
Rome is the city of echoes, the city of illusions, and the city of yearning.
I'm always yearning for it.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.